Hello everybody, James here, Storytime with Dutch, episode 48. And guess what, Dutch? You know when I just record, right? And then I realise that
yes,
I don't have any books to show. Anyway, we've got
what?
Books. We've got books somewhere in this room. They're over there, I can see them, but I've got my leg in like a sort of like ice stirrup, so I can't go grab them. But I've got two books, Owen Hart and The Rock. Search them, James Romero, or click links in the description of this video and every video and every podcast. Very, very nice and easy. Dutch has got two books as well, The World According to Dutch and Tales from a Dirt Road. You can get them on Amazon, or if you want them signed, you go to DirtyDutchMantel with two L's at gmail.com and you make your request there. We've also got a T-shirt that I've still lost. It's somewhere. You people mean nothing to me. And we will have more T-shirts out soon, Dutch. I'm telling you this for the first time, but we are going to have more designs and more T-shirts out soon as well. But for now, we've been talking about all the big questions, and now it's time to talk about wrestling on air.
Good. Well, today, folks, I'm on location. I'm in Orlando, Florida, at a beautiful timeshare hotel with two full bedrooms and a kitchen and a living room and a patio, and I look out onto the pool. And a beautiful day. I've been here 3 days, but a beautiful day today, and I'm actually really enjoying this. And this is the first time I've actually been out on the road in about, 6 months, 8 months, because usually I just stay home and watch TV and watch society crash all around me, and I just read about it. But, you know, you can get in a lot of trouble doing that. If anybody follows me on Twitter, you know what I'm talking about. If you say something that certain groups don't like, of course, you get attacked and they try to cancel you. Now, when you talk about canceling people, I don't know how somebody would cancel me, really. I just don't. If they cancel me, I guess just unfollow me, I guess. But I don't know why they were following me in the first place. I don't think my political stances on things should be a big surprise to anything. I'm not really liberal, and I'm not really that conservative. I'm in the middle, where I think most people should be. Then you can listen to both sides of an issue and decide from there. But anyway, I'm ready to talk wrestling today. And I never knew, James, that setting up in a brand new place is as difficult as it is. I'm sitting here and I'm going to admit I am technically ignorant of any kind of technology. I mean, when you plug this in and plug this in and turn this on and go to this setting, and it gets rough for me, but I am here, so let's talk some wrestling. And give me the hard questions.
I specialize in working with technophobic wrestlers and ex-wrestlers from across the pond, so you're in good company, don't worry.
Okay,
go ahead. No, come on. I mean, I do talk you through these technical challenges we have most weeks.
You do.
Has Kenny Bolin tried to cancel you yet?
Yes, he has. Now, for those of you who don't know Kenny Bolin, I think he will be a guest coming up soon, I hope. Because if you're not familiar with this Kenny Bolin fella, he's a friend and a lifelong friend of Jim Cornette. And they both got into the wrestling business. And I accused Kenny one time of allowing Jim to get him in, and he said, no, he got himself in. Jim wouldn't help him. But if you know who I'm talking about, he is a talking SOB and very, very entertaining, and we hope to have him on soon.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I've had him on my channel as well.
You've interviewed him, right?
I have interviewed him, yeah. I remember talking to him afterwards, and like basically, we wrapped up the show, and I said, Kenny, I'm really sorry. I've got six people downstairs. They're all waiting for me to play poker. So, because it was on my poker evening, so basically I had to cut the chat short about 15 minutes because there was some serious drinking and gambling that had to be done. But we definitely have to get a part two.
Well, we'll get it. Hopefully soon.
So we have wrestling to talk about, as we always do. Just before we get into the main news, a couple of things. One thing someone brought to my attention was a tease to Ted DiBiase story last week that I don't know if you told or not. I don't know if it was the one where he was caught by his wife, or there was another Ted DiBiase story that you wanted to bring up.
Oh, I got a lot of stories. This is the latest Ted DiBiase story. See, I do a lot of reading. I read a lot of news, and especially about people that I know and that I'm familiar with. Ted DiBiase got out of the wrestling business, which is another sermon that we could do one day, and he got into the evangelical business, the preaching business. And there's a lot of, you know, similarities between pro wrestling and pro evangelism. But since, and you mentioned he had a little trouble with his wife, and he admitted that he was addicted to some of that stuff. And I guess she forgave him, but he began preaching, and his sons, they got into wrestling too, but somehow they got into government in the state of Mississippi, where they live, where the DiBiases live. And they got a lot of state money to provide services to certain groups that weren't delivered. And what has happened is they got about $1 million or $2 missing that can't be accounted for. And now Ted, I hate to say this, he could have to be digging out a lot of money, or possibly even serving jail time. Mm. And his son, too. So the DiBiases are right now in deep trouble with the tax people in the state of Mississippi. And I hope they work that out, because Ted, I like Ted. I like him a lot, like his son. But it's the old scene that we've seen time and time again, not only with wrestlers, but everybody. Too much money that is available, you know, people can take it and misuse it. So I'm going to watch this story closely. And there's a lot more to the story that it's been 2 weeks since I've read this. I may have to go back and read it again and see what has happened about it.
Well,
I may be even late on it right now.
Yeah, we covered it in a decent depth last week. So I think we did about something like 16 minutes on the damn thing. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. talking all about that. But one more thing before we get to the news was you wrote to me and said something about Shinsuke Nakamura. Explain this, because I don't know the story.
Okay, I'm reading it like everybody does. I read my phone, and it says, former WWE personality says Nakamura needs to be fired. Well, I don't think I said he needs to be fired. I think I said he's been there too long. And even though they have two brands, he's still there in WWE. And if somebody never leaves, it's like they become a part of the furniture. And what I suggested is, and not only Nakamura, but a lot of those, the talent they have over there, has been there too long. And when they come out, people aren't excited. I mean, they're over, but it's like part of the furniture. It's like you walk in your living room and, oh, there's a couch. Well, yeah, you're glad you got a couch, but it's been there so long now, you don't even hardly notice it anymore. And that's what I was talking about. Great, great worker, great performer. But it's like if you see him all the time, and we're going to talk about Dusty, and I'll come back to Dusty later about appearances. But if you see somebody all the time on TV, eventually they get old hat. So what, unless you, and they don't put them in any kind of an angle either. They put them in maybe a little one, or just put them out there and just let them win or lose or whatever. But after a while, you lose your interest in that personality and that character.
Mm-hmm. I've got for you, I think it might be this one, Ringside News. Ex-WWE personality suggests Shinsuke Nakamura should be fired.
The headline sounds like I'm mad about something.
Well, I'm going to give you the quote. So this is what this is the quote that you said. Who was it to? It wasn't to me, so it must have been Sportskeeda. So I think every talent has a shelf life. They have a date stamped on. He, Shinsuke, has been there for 7 years, and after a while, he just fades into the woodwork. I think after 5 years, unless they are main event level stars, you need to let him go. 2 years, let him come back or something. I think they get stale, and if you don't really handle them right, you do more damage than they can help you.
Is that self-explanatory or what?
Yeah, that seems like really even-keeled and reasonable.
Yeah, let him take a break and come back. You know, when somebody's gone a good while, a year or so, and then they come back, now you're glad to see them again. Mm-hmm. Now you got at least a year and you can be worked in, and you have no get-over time. You're already over. They just haven't seen you for a while. And that's what I said. Never, never, never did I say, because I don't like people being fired. I don't. Because being fired to me designates you're fired with malice. You're fired because of a reason or somebody's mad at you or something. No, you're not. You have a shelf life just like anything else. You pick up a bottle of a gallon of milk. It says expiration date and it's got a date there. Do not use after. And there, it's there for a reason. And it should be there in wrestling. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they get there and they just stay there forever. I'll tell you another one but you don't see them on WWE that much anymore. And they did a good job with this. It was Dolph Ziggler. They sent him to NXT. So now at least he's off the main programs. And now if you want to see what he's doing, they're actually doing more with him in NXT, or they were, than they were doing in WWE with him. Mm-hmm. And he's another great talent.
It was Randy Orton as well. I mean, there's some people who've been there 20 years or near enough. I mean, what the old saying, how can we miss you if you don't go away?
Yeah. I mean, Dolph's been there over 10 or 12 years.
Oh, and the rest. I think he debuted in 2005 or 6 or something. So 17, 18 years.
Damn. I don't know who likes him, but apparently they're in love with him. Somebody. We'll leave that where it is.
Yep. We're going to talk about the news first, and then we are going to get into our main topic, which is going to be Dusty Rhodes. The Dusty Rhodes A&E biography was on not too long ago, so I thought it'd be nice to do some questions on Dusty and the people around Dusty. But for now, we're going to do the news, and the first order of business is Jeff Hardy last week. Returned to AEW after 10 months, saving his brother Matt from a beatdown. Now, Jeff was suspended indefinitely after a well-publicised DUI with blood alcohol 3 times the state limit, and it was not his first. Hardy entered a plea of nolo contendere, and he got 38 days in jail for time served, $4,500 in court fees, a 10-year suspension of his driver's licence, a court-mandated school or DUI programme, and community service. Now, Jeff has since completed a stint in rehab, and Matt recently claimed Jeff is more focused and doing very well. What are your thoughts on Jeff Hardy returning?
Well, I think he should have gotten more than 38 days in jail. It's his third DUI. I mean, I live by, and I think everybody should live by, my motto is, when somebody tells you who they are, believe them. Jeff Hardy is not going to start drinking. Stop drinking. He may, but he's shown us in the past that he's not going to stop. And he still goes out. He's still drinking. Now, when they arrest him the next time, which may be after he's killed somebody or himself, they said, well, we tried to do the best we can. Nah, people like that need to be put away for a while. I mean, 38 days in jail, that's like a month. And some guys, I don't know what jail he's in. Jail is not a pleasant place to be, but a month is not enough. See, I've come to the conclusion now that jail is not for punishment. It's for people's protection. We need the general public, like me and you, James, and everybody listening, the general public needs to be protected from people like Jeff. He's a great guy. He's a friendly guy. And when he gets drunk, excuse me, he doesn't want to hurt anybody. He don't want to kill anybody. But if he's out driving a 3,000-pound car and he hits somebody in another car, kills a child, kills some people in the car, or pedestrian, well, no matter how good a guy he is, they're still dead. And if the state knew about this, which they do, I think they should have done more. Yeah, I want Jeff to, and I've said this before, I want Jeff to straighten out. I like Jeff, but I also want to be protected myself. And Jeff's not the only one. They need to toughen up laws on drunk driving more than what they got. So that's all I'm going to say. Jeff, straighten your life out, buddy.
With Jeff physically, just before he was arrested and then suspended by AEW, the last few matches, he really seemed to be physically struggling quite a lot. And I wasn't sure that he was ever actually going to come back to wrestling at all, because I think he suffered a really bad concussion at the Double or Nothing pay-per-view when he teamed with Matt against the Young Bucks. And he just seemed to be noticeably moving a lot slower. Do you remember this from a year ago? And
I mean,
the guy must
be
in terrible pain.
Well, he could have been drinking too if he was moving slow. Because Jeff needs to realize he's not 22 anymore. I mean, those high-flying moves and death-defying moves, yeah, it got him to where he is today, but at a price. So moving slow, and after you get older, you feel it more. When you come off that ladder or whatever he came off on, I mean, that's a hell of a bump. Or even a young guy. And while I respect his desire to do that, his body can't do it anymore. And it takes one of those moves, then he's paralyzed. I don't know. I mean, watching Jeff Hardy is almost, you could almost see him deteriorate right in front of your eyes. And I like Jeff, and he was a great athlete and drew a lot of money. We had him out. I worked with him in TNA quite closely, and he would show up sometimes to the tapings. Fine. Hey, Jeff, how you doing? Oh, yeah, fine, man, fine. And 2 hours later, he couldn't even talk. So you didn't have to ask him what he did. You knew. So you just have to. We had him one night. He was supposed to do a run-in in a match. We couldn't find him. Have I told this before?
You may have. I can't remember. Tell me again.
And we looked and looked, and everybody was running around backstage. And I ran out to where his car was, and he was in his car. And the match that he was supposed to be standing by for was in the ring and actually was going longer than what they needed to go waiting for him. And I knocked on the window and he woke up. And I said, Jeff, you got to go to the ring. You got to go to the ring. And he went in, and he was only like 5 minutes late. But, of course, through the beauty of editing, I mean, we made it work. But I don't know. And he left. He left WWE. In the same way Kurt Angle left. I think they left with no 90-day protection clause. Because, and in Kurt's case, I think, and by his own admission, he was taking 60 pain pills a day. And I looked at him and I went, that's not possible, Kurt. He said, oh, yeah, it's possible. He said he would take 10 before he got up in the morning. I went, what? I mean, now I can't believe that. But he swears he would take 10 like Vicodins before. I don't know. Is that true? Can you take that many?
I think certain people have been able to build up like truly heroic tolerances and live through the other side. I mean, Shane Douglas says he was taking a fairly similar amount before he managed to kick the habit for good, but he was on OxyContin. I don't know if that even matters or anything, or if it's easier or harder to get off of. I think it's very, very hard to wean yourself off of both of them. He says he was taking dozens of pills every day as well.
Wow. But anyway, but they let him go, and somebody said, why would they let, oh, it's called no-compete clause. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. Usually they have a 90-day no-compete clause because, and that's put there for a reason, because they could do an angle with you, a hot angle, and you could just disappear and show up on your competition's show. That's happened before. Mm-hmm. But they waived the 90-day no-compete clause and just let him go. And when Kurt Angle came, I remember we had it was New Year's Eve, and I forgot what year, but that's when the show aired live, I think. And that's when we debuted Kurt Angle on TNA. And I don't know about the no-compete clause with Jeff Hardy. I think they may have waived that too. I don't know. But what that told me is they want to get rid of this person kind of fast. They don't want anything bad to happen while he was still employed or used by WWE, mm-hmm. which makes sense, really.
I'll look up the no-compete thing in a minute. But we're going to go to the next piece of news. CM Punk yet again is making the news, and this time reports are coming out that Punk is all but guaranteed to be returning to AEW probably as early as June, because I believe AEW's booked Chicago. With All In Wembley show coming up, they need all their star power they can get, and Punk is still their biggest star, despite not being on TV since September. Now, FTR have been publicly leaking information and posting messages from Punk saying Punk wants to return. Punk is now framing it that he's willing to work with the Young Bucks and Omega and Hangman and Jon Moxley when he buried the majority of them publicly on AEW broadcast. Now, there is a Deadspin article that lays all the blame on Punk without bringing up that Hangman went off scripts with Punk first. I think that does need to be also said. But this whole CM Punk thing and what this article suggests is CM Punk gaslighting his way back into AEW.
Now, gaslighting, what exactly does gaslighting mean?
Gaslighting means gaslighting, manipulate using psychological methods into questioning their own sanity or powers of reasoning.
Well, I think I had a phrase I used like a week or two ago on this show. A great heel is always a victim. Always. And I read the article you sent me and about FTR, they're like rallying or lobbying for CM Punk with Tony Khan. But yet, Punk has never said, I'm sorry. He's never apologized to really anybody. I mean, that's up to him. He can do that or not. But that's only half the story. Yeah, they need CM Punk, especially with Wembley and Chicago shows coming up and all this. They need him because he would help them. Because I think when people, CM Punk fans, when they talk about him, they talk about him as the good guy in this. Not the bad guy, the good guy. And that's the way he talks about it. But what hasn't been determined, he said he would work with Paige, said he would work with the Bucks, he would work with Omega. But wait a minute, has anybody asked them, would they mind working with Punk? And this is where Tony Khan is going to have to step it up. He's going to have to finally, and I've said this before, I don't want to sound like a repeating horn here, but Tony Khan needs to take charge of this. He needs to finally tell these guys, you're either going to work with him if he's going to bring him back. You're either going to work with him or I'm going to have to do something with you, which may make the talent probably madder than they already are and probably madder at Punk.
So do you think Tony Khan needs to force the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega and all these guys to just say, get over your feelings, just wrestle Punk, it's good for business?
Yeah, that's what. Are they in this business to make money or to soothe wrestlers' feelings? Okay, I'm going to tell everybody listening. You're a billionaire. He's a billionaire. Tony Khan's a billionaire.
His dad is.
His dad is. And probably Tony, he's not far from there either, I wouldn't expect. But he has access to money. So say he takes this money as a loan from his dad or whatever, but he's still got to pay it back. So is he in this business to make money? Or is he in business to coddle wrestler's feelings? You can't do both. And he needs to actually separate himself from the talent. And he can still be friends with them. But you don't have to go out and maybe drink with them or whatever he does with them. Because I think he got into business. And I met him a long time ago, way before I even knew that he was going to start a new company. And he knew all about me. He knew more about me than I sometimes think anybody did. But he is, because he's big on research, he's a smart guy. He really is. And that's why these guys, they can get him, what I think, they can get him behind the scenes and literally talk him into anything. Now, those guys can, a regular run-of-the-mill, like mid-card wrestler, won't be able to do that. But he likes them and he's willing to listen to them, which is fine. But when he needs Punk and the feelings are hurt, that's when he needs to be a boss and set them all down and say, hey, y'all going to have to come together. Mm-hmm. Or otherwise, you know. And I would tell Punk, you're going to have to fix this. And I'd give him a week to fix it. If he didn't fix it, then I'd move on. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems that the Wrestling Observer reported a few days ago there is a meeting scheduled soon in AEW with Chris Jericho, CM Punk, Tony Khan, FTR, and perhaps one other non-wrestler personality. So, at least Punk is going to be apparently sitting down with Jericho, who I know Jericho has been very public, is a dislike of Punk recently.
Well, I think Jericho would share the same feelings as I do. I think it's a good thing that Jericho's in that meeting, because Jericho's been around long enough to know that business comes before everything. And I think he'll tell Punk, but I think he'll use his seniority to tell Punk, who was, I guess Jericho's been in the business longer, but Punk has been in the business long enough to know this without being told. But he hasn't been told, if you don't do it, this is what's going to happen. See, I thought before all this that Punk would do a lawsuit, which is still not out of the realm of possibility. But I think if Jericho gets him behind the scenes and says, come on, Phil, blah, 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 we're going to Chicago, we're going to Wembley, we need you. And hey, Jericho may work to his vanity by putting him over and telling him to get along with these guys. I think that's the best thing to do, is say, hey, let's all get along. Let's all hug and make up, which is because I think business comes before anything else. That's what I think.
Shoot rivalries such as this, or, you know, some famous ones, Sean and Brett, for example, Shane Douglas and Ric Flair, in fact, that was another example off the top of my head. Do they make a feud better if there's genuine animosity between the two wrestlers, or does it not in the long term?
I don't think it makes it better. But I do think that if they can if they could instill in the fans' minds that there's legitimate heat between these two, it can't hurt it. It can only add to it. But as far as the two competitors, I think they want to have a good match, but yet at the same time, and you can have a good match with somebody you don't like. I've done it a lot of times. I mean, not to where the point where I wanted to fight him or anything. I could just maybe not really care for one guy, or he may not care for me. But still, I would go out there and have the best match I could with him.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Dutch, carry on.
And I would see if you have a have a match with a guy you don't like, and the first hard shot, you let it go. And the second one, you say, whoa. Then you start pounding back, and pretty soon you're beating the crap out of each other for no reason. I mean, you're not doing it for the fans. You're actually doing it because of it becomes personal. And then if that goes on long enough, it can turn into a full-fledged fight. And I've seen that happen too. Not a lot, but it has happened. So personal feuds, if the fans know it, yes, it does help the angle. But I don't know if it draws more money.
I wanted to bring this up. So FTR, I mentioned beforehand, obviously they're both big fans of CM Punk and Dax.
What does FTR stand for? Revival or something?
Fuck the Revival now.
What is it?
Fuck the Revival. It used to be The Revival, and now FTR stands for Fuck the Revival. Or it used to be that.
What's that mean?
I don't know. They don't like their old tag team name from WWE, I suppose. But I wanted to bring this up because Dax Harwood has a podcast, and generally he gets into the wrestling news websites to promote the podcast because he's got some direct line to Punk, and he gets a text message and some message to Punk, and then he's good advertising for the podcast. And breaking news, 1 hour ago as we record this, Dax Harwood has said he's cancelling his podcast because of basically he can't take the amount of criticism that he's getting from anti-Punk fans and anti-everyone else fans. Crikey, we get criticised every single week and we carry on, but yeah, what do you think of that?
Okay, who is this?
One of FTR.
Oh, canceling his podcast.
Dax. Yeah.
And Dax has a mustache.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't comment on your mustache, James.
Yeah, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it? I mean,
that looks very Vince McMahon-ish, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's saying he's canceling his podcast. I think I've read some of his stuff. I don't care. Don't mind. But I think he kind of believes his own publicity, that they are the greatest tag team in wrestling history. Didn't they say that?
Probably.
I mean, well. But again, when you get into the wrestling business, if you don't think you're the best or one of the best, you don't have any business being in it anyway. And I've seen their matches. They're good. They're a good tag team. I don't think they're the best tag team ever. And if you can't stay, the old saying, and you've heard it too, it's an old saying. I bet you heard your grandmother say this. If he can't take the heat, stay out of the kitchen. And if he can't take this, then don't do the podcast. Mm-hmm. And if people don't like what I say, don't listen to me. I'm not like twisting your arm saying you got to listen. If you don't like it, yeah, tell me. I don't care. But
there's something I want to bring up to you, and this is something I didn't write down for you, but I heard it recently, and I can't even find the quote, but CM Punk apparently was recently asked who his favourite booker was, and he said you. He said the reason was that you would give the answer, tell him exactly what you wanted somebody to do, why you wanted them to do it, and you'd also give Punk like an overarching view of the entire storyline and where this directive for this day fitted into it.
Well, I appreciate that. And Punk, when I worked for him in the early days of TNA, I read that he said that one where somewhere, and somebody said, what do you think about Dutch? He said, oh, Dutch is great. He'll tell you this. He said he fills you in on where it's going and what they want it to do and where they want it to go. And then I'd always tell him, and it's always open to interpretation. It's how you interpret what I give you and that we see, and we're going to look at it like fans, and we're going to say, well, I would like to see this. So, and to me, he was very, very easy to work with. But this was before his WWE days, and I don't know if that changed his mind or. But working in TNA with a booker like me, and I'm totally different than Vince. All bookers are different, and they envision things in different ways. But Punk could suggest something to me, and I would think about it. And if I thought it was a good idea, I'd say, yeah, put it in. With Vince, he's not like that. Vince is cut and dried. This is the way it's going to be. And he was that way about interviews, too. Almost word for word, he wanted you to deliver. Now, I would go out there on my interviews, and I wouldn't deliver it word for word. I would kind of restate it, reform it. I would get the same thought out, but in a different way. And he never said anybody to me. Chris Jericho said one time about Vince, because he changed something in the interview, and he came back and he said Vince was all upset about it. I mean, not upset to the point to where he was going to reprimand Jericho, because he was too over at that point. But he reminded him that those words were written for a reason, and he needed to follow it. So, but I appreciate CM Punk saying that. And I only worked with him a brief time. Then he got into a fight with Teddy Hart.
Yes.
I think that was before that. And I don't know. And then I think Phil, he quit coming, or they quit booking him or something. I forgot.
I'm just looking at Wikipedia. Punk officially quit TNA March 2004 during the Rob Feinstein controversy after having a dispute with the TNA officers over his ability to compete in Ring of Honor following a TNA order that their contracted wrestlers were no longer wrestle in Ring of Honor. So basically, mm-hmm. It was one or the other. I think he had to choose, so he chose Ring of Honor.
I think that was it.
Yeah. We shall move on. One more bit of news and we'll get on to Dusty Rhodes, but I wanted to bring attention to Stevie Richards' health. It has been improving as of late since suffering numerous health issues related to his back and neck, we think. I'm not sure there's any information of exactly what's happened, but he's on the slow road to recovery and he is IVing antibiotics every few hours around the clock, 24 hours a day, even in the middle of the night. Do you have any Stevie Richards stories with working with him? Because I know you worked with him in TNA.
I didn't work that closely with him in TNA. I remember him there, but I don't have a lot. I don't know Stevie that well. I met him, good guy, great worker. I actually remember him more when Bradshaw went to, what was it, Ring of Honor, ECW or whatever, and he beat up Blue Meanie.
Yes.
And Stevie Richie was there. I remember him that, because that was, I have never even talked to Bradshaw about that. He may not even want to talk about it. We should bring Bradshaw on this show.
I've told you this, we should bring Bradshaw on the show. I think he knows, I could ask him. Well, you've got his number, you ask him.
Yeah.
He likes you better.
I'll ask him. Oh, yeah. John is another interesting son of a bitch. I bet 200,000 miles with him, listening to him. He's funny as hell. And to pass the time, me and John would be riding down the road, and he'd say, did I ever tell you about the time I worked for the fire department in some town? No, what happened? And then he'd start this long story. And then I said, I heard about that, and then I would add to the story. I said, I heard you saved a pregnant woman, and you delivered a baby on top of a burning building. Oh, yeah, well, I'd kind of keep that quiet. And he would just go back and forth as we made our way down the highway, and that's how we entertained ourselves. It's called Bullshit Unlimited. And I had the greatest time with that guy. Now, that was my first run in WWE, and my second run was with Jack Swagger. And I talked to him not too long ago. I told him, I said, brother, if it hadn't have been for you, I wouldn't have made it in WWE. Because he did a lot of things for me. Hell, I wasn't young then, but he would help me with my bags and help me and get me in the hotel and all this kind of stuff. Without that, I would have had a very difficult time doing it, and I thanked him because I love Swagger, and I love John Layfield.
On this very show, you thanked him.
Great, great friends and hilarious. They're funny guys because without the humor, and I think that's why guys like to ride with me, because I'm I'm just bullshitting all the time, and you don't know where it's coming from or where it's going to end up. But it's interesting. If you ride with somebody that doesn't say a lot, it is a chore. Because you're not being entertained, and you just see that white line going by. Keep going, keep going, keep going.
Who are the worst? Who are the ones who would bore you to death on the road?
Who's this?
Who would just be the worst travel partners who never spoke or were just unentertaining?
Well, I never rode with anybody like that. Because I kind of took charge, and I tried to make it entertaining, and usually they would join in. I'll tell you, a guy that doesn't talk a lot is Cesaro, I'm sorry. He didn't talk a lot, but he enjoyed my bullcrap. And if I got an audience, I'm fine. If he's laughing and he's liking it, and it's like performance time when I get in the car, I don't care how long the trip is. If it's 3 hours, it's 3 hours of Dutch doing bullshit and talking and disagreeing with people. But when we would disagree, we'd disagree in a civil tone, like a joke. But I've seen some of those jokes in cars with guys backfire. Oh, and that's when you'd have a few fights on the road. And I said, what do you mean by that? And what do you mean by this? And I can't remember any of the fights, but they've been a few.
Certainly been a few. They've certainly been a few. Some of them fake fights, just to wind up a third person in the car, I believe, as well. But that's for another day. That's for another day. Fargo's and such, I'm sure. We are going to move on to our main event, as it were, and we're going to be talking about Dusty Rhodes. Some Dusty Rhodes-based questions. There was an A&E documentary out. WWE produced, spent a shocking amount of time on Dusty's WWF career, would you believe? Gave Pac songs, like, you know, the big turn in 74, whenever it was, about 10 seconds. But as I say, it's a WWE thing, and you know what to expect. Dustin was really good on it as well. He was really emotional, really, you know, he's got a ton of depth to him, and, you know, his really intense feelings when it comes to his father. But we'll talk about Dustin as well. Dusty's wrestling hero, like so many, Gorgeous George, he gets into the business. And the first bit of fame he gets is rolling around Florida and AWA and loads of other places with his tag team partner, Dick Murdoch. I've never asked you about Dick Murdoch or any stories you've got about that guy, so now's the time.
Dick Murdoch, I love that guy. But this is the reason he loved me. Because he's a bullshit artist too. And when we get together, it was back and forth. And he liked that. And he always liked me. I always liked him. So a story about Dick. Oh, he'd get in a fight every week that he used to. Somewhere, some bar or something. Because he had what they call a 6-inch punch. He'd go right here and bam. He wouldn't swing way back and hit the guy. He'd just punch him. And he had such a strong punch that would really stop a lot of fans from kind of attacking him. Because back in the day, ladies and gentlemen, wrestling lived and died on heels having heat. That means the people came to see the heel get his ass handed to him. And that's how we made money. That's how we sold tickets. But Dick, I was in Puerto Rico one time. We had this big guy there. He was about 6'10", 6'11". And Dickie was the booker. So he went in to book, but this guy was already there. And Dickie and this guy did not get along. So we were in, and I came in one weekend. I came in on a Friday, and I was going to do a Saturday show and a Sunday show. And I met the guy, and I heard all this stuff later that they didn't like each other. But we were in a town called Ponce, Puerto Rico. Or maybe it could have been somewhere else. But he told the guy to do something, and the guy didn't do it. And the next thing I know, I thought this was the finish. Dickie went to the ring and beat the living crap out of this guy. he was pounding, kicking him. He said, "I told you, you son of a." And he was literally mad. I went, "What the hell is this?" And then I learned later that Dickie and this big 6'11" guy were having issues. And so Dickie took it, and Dickie, I heard, had already talked to him and said when he sends something out, he expects it to be followed. And he thought this guy was backstabbing him. Like he's going to go out there and do what he wanted to do, regardless of what Dickie said. So Dickie went out there and just beat the crap out of him and left him laying. So.
I didn't realize he's booked. Oh, I'm going to just messed up the camera. He's booked more than one territory, hasn't he, Dickie? I didn't realize he was sort of a. I mean, didn't he like buy into a territory with Blackjack Mulligan at one point?
Yeah, but I didn't last long. Where was that?
Great question. I don't know if it was somewhere in Texas or where does Terry Funk live?
Amarillo.
Yeah, I don't know if it was like somewhere around Amarillo or something. I'm probably just making up something.
No, I'd heard that too, but it didn't last long for some reason. I don't know. Because you can be great at wrestling and be the shits in business. You know, you got to bring in more money than you're paying out. That's called creating a profit so you can invest back into your business and keep going. What they did, they may have been paying out more than they were taking in, therefore creating a loss, but you can't stay in business long like that.
One of his later jobs that I think sort of gone into legend, didn't he work for like a brewery as just somebody, they just hired him to just send him to bars and just party with the locals? It was like Coors or something like that.
I never heard that. Yeah. But that would have been a great job for him.
It was a great job. I've got a couple more things about Dickie. And one thing is that I don't think that many people realise as well is that I believe that Dick Murdoch turned up at the 1995 WWF Royal Rumble around the time that you were debuting. And
yep.
Was Dickie around for a few months? They never put him back on TV, but I believe that he was just sort of hired around the company for a few months just to amuse the boys. Is that true, or do you remember him being there for any amount of time?
No, I remember him being there. I remember sitting down talking to him. And I don't even know. They didn't use him worth a crap. He was just there at every TV. Then I don't even remember him. I just remember him at TV tapings. I don't remember him really on the road because they didn't really put him to work. I think what they wanted him to do maybe was probably shift him toward a producer's role or an agent's role backstage. And I don't know. But see, this is how easy it is to get what I call rolled in the WWE. The agents have a meeting with Vince. "How'd it go, boys?" Mm-hmm. Or he'd ask Chief J. Strongbow, "How did so-and-so do with that finish?" He went, "Well, you know, Vince," that's all he's got to say. Well, if it's not a glowing endorsement, he didn't say, "Man, he took that, people were standing. I mean, it was really, really good." But if the chief would take an attitude like, Vince, that's it. Vince took that to saying, "Well, the guy's the shits. So let's don't do anything with him and we'll get rid of him." That's all it took. He wanted these agents to really give him a glowing report. All right, the agent gave, he said, "Well, it was okay, but it could be a lot better." Vince would take that as a negative. And it kind of was, but it's kind of not. It's kind of in the middle. But you don't know how Vince would take it. So it wouldn't take much to convince Vince that whoever you were, that person is not the talent he's looking for.
So Dickie was not just agent material then, was he?
Well, I think Dickie had a different way. He was like me. He was more direct. And I think Vince did like him. But I think Vince gets bored easily after a couple of months. I think Dickie had maybe served his purpose. And how long was he there? He wasn't...
Not too long. I mean, I've heard anything up to 6 months, but I don't even know if it was 6 months.
No, I don't think it was 6 months either. But the thing in wrestling, sometimes you say, well, it was only 3 months. It could have been like a year and a half. How you get that amount of time confused, I don't know. But he wasn't there long.
No.
But he was a great, great worker. He was in WCW when I was there too. So we went to a show one time. I'm watching him. Dickie didn't take the big bumps, but when he did, it meant something because he knew when to put it in and when to not to put it in. I saw him just take an arm drag. Excuse me. He sold that arm drag for 5 minutes and had the people up. He was going, oh, my back, oh, and he'd get out of the ring and sell and sell and sell. And if you're watching it, you say, damn, he must have really got hurt. Then he'd get back in there and he'd do something and he'd take another one. Oh, my God. Now, really, if you're trying to tell a story and he takes two arm drags and he has sold them that much, now he gets back in the ring. That's why he cheats. He rakes the guy's eyes or does something. Because now at least he has a reason to do that. And now the people are mad at him because, well, he was, they were where they had felt sorry for him before a little bit. Now he does something dirty. Now they turn on him. Mm-hmm. And I've seen him go in a match with no angle or nothing. And at the end, have him standing, which takes talent. Mm-hmm. But the talent has to know what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And Dickie knew that. I don't know if you can learn that, but I think Dickie self-taught himself this. So great, great talent in the ring.
And I've seen quite a few Dick Murdoch matches, and I always love the thing where he gets knocked down and then he does the whoop, 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 you know, that sort of like running man in a circle on the mat thing.
Oh, it's too much. Great guy. I mean, when Dick would go to the ring, in all the matches I've seen, I would usually go out and watch his match because it entertained me. And if you can't entertain yourself, you're going to get bored real quick.
Let's talk about, I know it was about Dusty Rhodes. We went straight into Dick Murdoch there. But Dusty, first time you met Dusty?
I think I met him when I went to Florida the first time. I think it was in 76, 77. I mean, that's before a lot of these people that are listening to this podcast were born. But I went down there and I didn't wrestle him much. I remember wrestling one time on TV, which was nothing but a 3 minute display of Dusty's elbows on top of my head and him punching me and doing this and, you know, doing the Dusty stuff, which was over. Of course, I was young in the business, and of course, I was selling everything. But I never worked with Dusty, maybe that one time.
Really?
No, because this is why. See, Dusty, when he would go to the house shows, he was always the main event, always. I was usually the second match, or no more than the third match most times. I was a preliminary match because I was young in the business. That's where I should be. I should be going on early, getting experience, watching the masters at work later on. And one reason Dusty was over, and we talked about this earlier, I talk about Nakamura needs to take a break because he got old. Dusty never got old. This is when I first realized that staying off TV can work for you. And the reason Dusty would stay off TV, because if he was on TV too much, he'd wear out his welcome. He made the people buy a ticket to actually see him wrestle. The same way Hulk Hogan, Vince had Hulk Hogan do back in the Hogan years. You never saw Hogan on TV unless it was a pay-per-view. But you always had to pay to see Hogan because he was special. Dusty was special in Florida. So if he had a TV match, which I don't remember him having the whole time I was there, it would actually mean something. And that was the first time I saw less is more. Mm-hmm. And he worked it to a T. Because Dusty could go out on an interview, and this is an old saying in wrestling, you talk them into the building. You talk them in. And that's what Dusty did. Because he was over. Really, really over.
Honky Tonk Man very famously publicly claimed that those elbows really hurt when he dropped them on your head. Did you find that as well?
Well, yeah, he's kind of stiff. But, hey, I don't mind that. The Honky Tonk Man, when you talk about him saying that it hurt, you couldn't touch Honky Tonk Man. Honky Tonk Man, you'd go to, he'd say, you pull his hair, hey, easy on the wig, easy on the wig. He didn't have a wig. That's what he would say. Austin Idol, too. Whoa, whoa. Sometimes they would beg off before you hit them. But I can see Wayne doing that. Wayne was my partner in Puerto Rico for about 6 months. I love that guy.
We need to have Honky on. He recently did a podcast with Dan Severn. So he's out there. He's doing a show here and there. So we've got to have him on.
Yeah, we'll have him on.
Yeah, go on.
He's doing a show where?
Do you remember Dan the Beast Severn?
Oh, yeah, I remember him. I thought you were saying
something else. Old school UFC. He did a podcast with him as a guest. We'll move back to Dusty, though. Dusty as a booker. Dusty's style as a booker. Talk to me about and probably how much it differed from maybe Eddie Graham's vision of how wrestling should be.
Well, Eddie Graham was his mentor. Eddie Graham loved Dusty. And if you knew Eddie's past, Eddie was from that era of, you know, really rough, you know, not a lot of high spots, just beating people up. But he saw Dusty and he had sense enough to realize that, well, let's do it his way for a while. And it paid off. And it didn't hurt the business. See, a lot of the old timers thought if you did a lot of this stuff, it actually took the legitimacy out of it. And even guys my age who were starting out, we looked at those guys like, you don't know what you're talking about. It's in a new era. A lot like the guys that are in the business today, look at me, or look at some of the old timers saying, you don't know what you're doing. But we kind of do, or we think we do anyway. But Dusty learned everything about booking from Eddie Graham. And wait a minute, there's some people around. You hear that?
Yeah, one sec. Sorry, quick break there. So the last words were Dusty learned everything from Eddie.
And in so learning, I think Eddie learned a lot from Dusty. Now, talking about Eddie was such a good, what they call a finish man. I remember some promoters calling Eddie up personally and telling him the whole story of how this angle progressed, or their angle in their own territory, and ask him what he would do in certain situations. And he would give them his opinion. He was that well-respected within the wrestling community. Bill Watts used to call him. Jim Barnett used to call him, and also the Crocketts would call him up and ask him what he would do in certain situations and how to keep it going. I mean, just because you have a sellout doesn't mean you're going to have a sellout next week or keep it going. But Eddie would figure out ways, and he would do a finish where usually the baby face went over, but then the heels come back in and killed him. I mean, you could do that in those days, and you could still do it today if you did it right. And people ask me, well, how you know you're doing it right? I said, oh, your next house will tell you. If you didn't do it right, you know you did it the wrong way. But Dusty learned a lot of his stuff from Eddie. And the reason he stayed over, not only in Florida, but when he went to Crockett, Mid-Atlantic, you never saw him on TV. You just saw his interviews. And Dusty would book cards with Magnum TA on top, or Nikita Koloff. Yeah. And who was the nephew? What was his name?
No, Nikita Nikolov. Was the nephew. Ivan was the uncle.
Ivan Koloff. Nikita Koloff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and he got those two going. Then he had the Road Warriors. Then he had the Rock and Roll Express, who were already made by the time that they went to Mid-Atlantic, because they were made in Memphis, and they were like realigned in Mid-South with Watts, because he saw what Jerry Jarrett had done with them and got them over. And so when they were leaving Memphis, they sent them 4 weeks of like little vignettes, and they were over when they got there. And the first night in, they beat the Koloffs for the titles. They were over, instantly over. And then Crockett got word news of that, and Dusty, then they brought them there. So Dusty had all these guys over. Magnum TA, he got him over in Florida. He took him to Crockett. And how Dusty stayed over and made so much money, not only did he get Booker's money, he was in the main event most of these big shows. And he would be main event with Magnum TA versus somebody, or a six-man tag with the Rock and Roll Express versus somebody, or the Road Warriors and Dusty against the Andersons and Ric Flair. So, but what Dusty would do, he would book the big shows with him on top. And from what I've heard, who was his assistant, Jim? He was a manager.
J.J. Dillon.
J.J. Dillon would fill in the undercard, which sounds about right. Sounds good. Because he would book the main events, and J.J. would book, say, from the semifinal on down, which was fine. It worked, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But everything that happened there, I mean, the major stuff was all Dusty's idea, but the things underneath that was probably JJ's idea. Mm-hmm. So, but he was a good booker, good to work for, and you could actually talk to him.
Now, Dusty's booking style, very creative, came up with some of the best things in WCW/Jim Crockett promotions, you know, like the concept of Starcade. I think he gets credit for War Games, the Great American Bash Summer Tour. I mean, he's come up with some stinkers around, like that Halloween cage match where Abdullah the Butcher was electrified in the electric chair as well, but and Shotmaster. Dusty seems to receive, like, especially in the 80s Crockett run, equal shares of praise and negative comments as well. As you said, he kept himself on top. He was always in his name was always on all the wrestlers' lips, even yours. Even if you had nothing to do with him, he would say something like, "All right, Dutch, you got 2 minutes. Talk about me for 40 seconds, and then you can say whatever it is for the Crockett Cup 1987 or something later." What are the pluses and minuses as Dusty as a booker?
Well, I don't remember being told to talk about him. I may have.
I've got a video of you doing it, in fact. It's like, just before I say anything, I just want to say, Dusty, it's an absolute damn shame that's happened for 30 seconds. Then you talk about something else.
Well, I may have been told to say about that, because that doesn't sound like something I would say. But I was probably told to say that to accent how the rest of the wrestlers would think about something that happened to Dusty. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, I mentioned him on my interview, which kind of puts me in his space. So it kind of works. I didn't feel pressed upon to do it. I mean, when somebody says, say this, well, you're working for them. They're paying you to work, so say what they want you to say. I'm fine with that. And what was the rest of your question?
Sort of the pros and cons of Dusty as a booker, because he's, you know, very creative, come up with some great things. Some of his booking maybe toward 88, some people might complain about, and money was lost. And I don't know, the best and worst of Dusty as a booker, I suppose.
Well, I like Dusty. Thought he was very creative. And the reason I left was not because of Dusty's booking. Well, it was really. But they bought another territory in Florida. They took it over. And Dusty was going to call it Charlotte South. And I thought, that doesn't make sense. Why would you go to Florida and do a wrestling show called Charlotte South? Which, yeah, it is south of Charlotte, but to the fans in Florida, what does that mean? But he was taking a bunch of people and just telling them to go to Florida. And I said, guys, I just can't do that. I just left there like a year ago, and I don't want to go back right now. Because you don't want to go back when they're trying to restart something. Because they're going to have a lot of glitches in the system. Nobody's going to make any money. And they didn't guarantee me any money to go. So I didn't go. That's the only reason I left. I left Crockett Promotions in the first place. And I ended up going to Continental and had a good run there. Then I ended up going back to Memphis.
We can't talk about Dusty's booking without maybe, it wasn't even his creation, but the Dusty Finish. Where did the Dusty Finish come from, and why is it named after Dusty?
Well, Dusty would go to a town, and I know what he was trying to do. He was trying to leave them in a positive frame of mind, because he would have, I think the heel would do something, and then they would continue the match, and then the babyface would do the same move that the heel did on him, like put foot on the ropes, and the babyfaces would go over, which people in the house were excited. Then they would go back on TV and reverse the decision because the baby face cheated. And they would have film of it. And it's called the Dusty Finish. And it kind of backfired on him. Instead of just having a DQ and a heel beating the hell out of the guy, they'd kind of put the baby face over, but then go back on TV and disappoint the fans after they believed that the babyface had won. It's called Dusty Finish. It got more prevalent in the dirt sheets, because the dirt sheets then were like the Twitter of today. People bitch about anything, and they started calling that the Dusty Finish, especially Dave Meltzer. The Dusty Finish, the Dusty Finish. And he called him the Dusty Finish. Well, that finish had been used for years in wrestling. And without the dirt sheets, it wouldn't have caught on, really. But when the smart marks kind of took it over, then the regular marks who don't read Meltzer, don't even know who Meltzer is, they kind of caught on to it. And it developed a life of its own, as evidenced by you just bringing it up, the Dusty Finish. I think it was much more talked about in the dirt sheets and the smart sheets than anything else.
Who do you think invented it? Do you know? I always heard Eddie Graham may have invented it.
It's an old wrestling finish. It's been used for years and years and years, but maybe not to the extent, maybe Dusty used it too much. Hey, just because you're a good booker don't mean you can't make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And Dusty, if he was still with us, he would tell us, yeah, he made a lot of mistakes.
With Dusty's charisma and interview skills and everything else, Hulk Hogan's on this A&E documentary and just says when he first got to Memphis, he was doing a really lame Dusty Rhodes impersonation when he was being interviewed by Lance, and I'm sure a lot of other people were as well, because superstar Billy Graham, he was like the prototype that so many people copied. I'm sure a lot of people copied Dusty as well. Do you know who were maybe some of the best imitators of Dusty Rhodes' style? Because I wrote one down for you as well, but I won't say it.
I know who it is.
Go on.
And I read what you wrote down, but it immediately came to mind, Dream Machine. Dream Machine did a Dusty, and I don't know if it was a Dusty impression or it was a Dream Machine impression that he just came up with. Because here's a story from the past. Troy Graham was the Dream Machine's name out from under the hood. Jimmy Hart managed him. And he used to have some sayings I'd never heard before. He'd say, I wish I thought about this before I went on. I can't remember it now. Graveyard dying or lying or something. But it was really, really good. I remember it. I'll do it on next week's show when I think about it. But the Dream Machine, Dusty heard Dream Machine doing the interview. And he went out of his way to personally get a hold of Jimmy Hart, I think, who was managing Dream Machine, and wanted him to come, I think, to Mid-Atlantic, to Charlotte.
It's going to be graveyard digging and a coffin a-buying. Is it that?
Right.
There you go.
Yep, that's it. Graveyard digging, coffin buying, old times something and something flying. It was, but when he would just put that in an interview, oh, it's magical. You say, what the hell is this guy? The Dusty saw a tape of him and loved him. And he wanted to bring him to Charlotte to work against him. I mean, he was going to be Dusty's personal selection to come in and work against Dusty, which the end run would have been that the Dream Machine would eventually turn babyface and join Dusty in their quest to rid Mid-Atlantic of all these dastardly bad guys. And Dream, when he heard what Dusty wanted to do, he turned him down.
Really?
He turned him down. He said, nope. He said, I'm Memphis born and I'm Memphis bred. And when I die, I'm going to be Memphis dead. That's why he said, because I think he said that, but he couldn't leave Memphis, I think, because his sister was, I think, really involved in drugs. She was like an addict. And his mother was older. The daddy, they don't know where he went. He's really a tragic story, but he would not leave his mother and he wouldn't leave his sister to go somewhere else, which I respect him for that. Mm-hmm. And the last, and Dream's dead now. Great, great guy. I'm sitting in, we go on this trip one time. I think we went to Louisville. So we share a room. And I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I look over, there's Dream Machine, the light on. And he just looking straight ahead like this. And I look at him, and he must have been really messed up on something. And I've never told this story before, but he had a blade in his hand and he had bladed himself and it had run down his face onto his chest. Brother, you talk about, I came out of that bed. I said, what the fuck are you doing? Hey, brother. Hey. He said, oh, man, I just can't sleep. I said, I thought it was nuts. And I finally, you know, made him go clean himself up, get back in the bed, and I tried to go. But I couldn't sleep then. I said, my thought was, you know, if a guy's going to injure himself over there, I know he don't give a shit about me. The hell, he could be over here stabbing me in the neck with that. That was the first time and the last time I ever shared a room with Dream Machine. And I loved him to death. The last time I saw him, I made an independent show. And this was after the Memphis territory had kind of closed down. But, you know, fans never forget. So I made this independent show right across the line from Memphis to West Memphis, Arkansas. And I made a shot for an independent group over there. And I saw Dream, which I hadn't seen 3-4 years, and it was almost pathetic what I saw. He was a guy, he used to be a big guy, he was kind of thin, I mean, he still had the talk, he still had the voice, but he was horrible. And he asked me, could I loan him any money? And I did. Hell, that could have been me too. I'm a sucker for that. But I gave him some money, and that's the last. And the next thing I heard, about 6 months later, he had died. So I'm glad I gave him the money, because sometimes things happen to people. Things happen to good people. Troy Graham was a good guy, really good guy. But and I'm not saying any of these things happened, because I think it was the way he was brought up, the culture that he was around. But the ending wasn't what I'd wish for him, and I'm sure he'd thought about it. He wouldn't wish it on himself either. But I'm glad I knew him. One thing about Dream, he heard Andy Kaufman doing that interview. I may have covered this before.
No.
And Andy Kaufman would get on Memphis TV why he was hated so bad. And this is where I got, don't attack your opponent so much. Attack the people that support your opponent. And he said, oh, yeah, come this Memphis, Tennessee down here. Oh, yeah. Oh, man, he was hilarious. And it made Dream so mad. Dream come up to me right after the interview, and he says, you know, Dutch, they shouldn't allow him to do that. I went, Dream, it's an interview. You're supposed to do it. I don't like it. Because he made fun of Memphis people. And he's like you said, he was Memphis born, Memphis bred. And when he dies, he'll be Memphis dead. But I never will forget that. Dream didn't like the interview. Later on, he learned to like Andy a lot.
So Dream Machine sort of sounds like the Buddy Landell, you're sort of like Buddy Landell and Ric Flair and Dream Machine and Dusty Rhodes in that sense. That they actually could have feuded, and then they both just didn't for whatever reason.
Well, but think of that. Dusty and Dream Machine together versus Flair and Buddy Landell.
What a match.
I would pay money just to hear the interviews. Because Dream would go out there and he'd think about the interviews. Dusty kind of had an interview, but if he got Dream Machine with him, there's no telling what they could have come up with. That to me is a dream team. And if anybody doubts Dream Machine's ability to cut the interview, go to YouTube. And these are interviews that he just cut off the top of his head when the camera was on. And if you're familiar with Buddy Landell, watch some of his interviews, because years ago, we didn't have writers that write down interviews for us. We had bookers that came to us and said, listen, go out there, talk about this, and on this date in this town, and go out there and sell some tickets. That's all you had. Then you go out there and you could talk about your prior difficulties or your problems with these people and make it interesting and make it sell.
We will move on. And a big theme through the A&E documentary on Dusty Rhodes is issues with pro wrestling and being on the road and maintaining a family life, which you really can't. And unless you bring your family with you to every territory you go to, which oftentimes is not really practical. How do you maintain relationships and marriages on the road? It's got to be difficult. And as somebody who's been on the road many decades, you'll have an insight.
Well, a lot of guys would seek out territories where they could stay. And Charlotte was a good territory for that, because they kept guys for a long time. Florida, maybe. Texas, maybe. And Memphis would keep guys. Maybe the little crew around them. I was in that crew for about 5 years. And I was, you're in the standby bunch. But if you got to move every year with the family, it's very, very difficult. And it's hard on the kids. It's hard on the husband and wife. And that's why the divorce rate in wrestling it was really high. There's been a lot of stories about Say I get, or say somebody gets mad at Ric Flair, and they know he's going to a certain town and he's going to be doing a certain thing, and they tip off his wife, and she goes to this other town 100 miles away, and they give her a time because this informant knows all this is going on. And she knocks on the door, opens the door, and there's Ric Flair. I don't know if this really happened, but Ric Flair, and there's a woman in the room. So the wife has the goods. And Ric has been married 4 or 5 times. And I think that's, and a lot of wrestlers have been caught that way. Terry Funk got caught one time and kept telling his wife that, no, he don't remember it. That's what I heard.
Gaslighting, a perfect gaslighting. Though.
And finally, I think they say, and I love Terry, but I think she believed it. And hell, now I believe it. Yeah. If he told me, but it was very difficult to keep a family together, hard on the kids. But it would be, say I was living in, say, in Tennessee, and I went to Florida. Well, I'm going to be gone at least a month before I get back to see the kids or see my wife or anything. When I went to Puerto Rico, it eventually becomes either the job or the marriage. And you can see why. Because the wife didn't marry a guy who's going to be gone all the time. She wanted him to be there, like husband should be, to support the wife, support the kids. And he could be sending her gobs of money, but still it's not the same thing as he's there. Mm-hmm. Tough life. Yeah. It really is.
What percentage, and this does relate to the documentary as well, especially with Dustin, but what percentage of wrestling sons do you think got into the business simply to be closer to their father?
Well, actually, I read that question. I think it's actually the percentage of wrestling fathers who got in to be next to their sons, who got them in. There were some wrestlers who didn't want their kids in the business, I'm sure. But I would say that most of the guys I know, and you're saying guys who wanted to get in the business, I think Jeff Jarrett wanted to get in, but I don't think his daddy wanted him to get in that much. But he said, I want to do it. He said, well, okay, let's go. And he got him in, and he's been very, very successful. And Dusty got Dustin in, and then he helped get Cody in. And it's like Vince McMahon got his whole family in. So I would say probably the percentage-wise, I would say all of them that got their sons in is like at least 100%. They wanted to help their son succeed in the business they didn't understand.
We're going to talk about Dustin then. So Dustin breaks into the business in Florida. I think he actually broke into Texas, actually, but like had one match in Texas and then full-time in Florida. So memories of a young Dustin. I don't think you met him in Florida, did you?
No, I didn't meet him there. I knew of him, but I didn't meet him there. Actually, I met him in Memphis. He came to Memphis. And good talent. You know, Dustin actually, he had the look. He was tall. He was about 6'4", 6'5". He had the look. And I think Memphis helped him.
Well, Florida.
I didn't meet him in Florida. I just met him in Memphis.
Oh, Dustin was in Memphis?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't even know.
Oh, yeah, he was in Memphis. I got a picture of him. It was a Rock and Roll Express, Dustin, Dundee, me. We're walking out. We're all in this picture. It's kind of a blurry picture. But I was walking out as Texas Dirt with the mask on. And I forgot where we were. I think we were in like some town in Kentucky or some. Somebody got a shot and sent it to me. But yeah. But see, these guys get sent to different territories before they allowed a spot in a bigger one. because they want them to learn before exposing them to a larger audience.
Did he have talent from a young age? I mean, if you've met him, he's only been in the business like a year and a half. Can you sort of just tell that he's born to do
it? Oh, yeah. Listen, if you don't get the business within 6 months, I mean, basically, not necessarily the good spots and all that, but actually doing the moves, you're not gonna get it.
In WCW, so I think you and he were in WCW together in 1991, and I know Eric Watts got this really, really badly, as far as basically being the son of a wrestling legend, and then everyone in the locker room thinks, oh yeah, you only got here because you're the son of so-and-so, which of course, you know, is at least partially true. But did Dustin have a lot of issues as far as navigating like political waters in the sense of people disliking him for the position he was put in?
Not like Eric Watts did. Eric Watts, he had some major issues with that because basically he wasn't ready to be in the role that they put him in. Dustin at least spent several years learning the business before he ever ended up going to WCW. And then when Vince put him on the gold dust angle, he was ready for that. And he did that in such a way that I didn't think Dustin would do, but he bought it and he worked on it. And it's kind of a gayish angle. And he did a great job on it. He really did. I think they both got fired from WCW. Where did they do the match in the ring going around the city?
Oh, that was terrible. That was Blacktop Bully, Demolition Smash as well. That was in WCW like 94 or something.
Didn't they get fired for that?
Someone got fired for it. Didn't they bleed and they were told not to?
Yeah, but it's something like that. But so they was on. Were they on a truck?
They were on a truck, on a flatbed truck, and they were fighting on it, and they had a helicopter like camera panning and flying around with it, or it seemed like that way anyway.
And it was now, can you imagine driving around, say, 275 or whatever it is around Atlanta, 475, or whatever it is, and you pass a ring with two guys in it having a match? What would you think? And there's a helicopter up there, and you would say, what the hell is this? I wonder, I'm sure they had, like, did they have police escorts?
I can't. It's been so long since I've seen it. I remember that being on the WrestleCrap website, really, you know, years and years ago. It was just one of those oddity matches. That must have been a Dusty creation, surely.
I don't know. I don't think that was the... When I was in... I don't think that was a Dusty creation. I really don't. I think it was... I don't know. I forgot. All these eras run together for me.
Well, let's talk about Goldust briefly. Oh, well, Dusty did booking in the early 90s as well, on and off. I think he traded with Ole and Ric Flair and stuff like that. But we'll go on to the Goldust character. Now, I believe this is one of Vince Russo's first big projects before he became the head writer like a year or so later. Mm. Do you remember the first time Goldust came out, you know what I'm saying, entered the arena, and just like the vitriol he must have got, or were just people just like baffled and completely silent? Do you remember the reactions he was getting originally?
Well, like you said, the people were like, they didn't know what he was, but it didn't take them long to fill it in. Now, let me say one thing about wrestling crowds years and years and years ago as compared to now. They had no problem calling him the slur words for homosexual. They had no, and then you would have the whole audience at one point saying that word. Little kids too. So, I mean, if you did that today, people would just, they'd go crazy. You couldn't do that. But that was the vibes he got. But by the same token, you could take that same character and make him a good guy, and nobody would say nothing. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though he didn't have to change his character, but if he helped the good guy, if he helped the baby face, they'd love him then. So where's all this anti-homosexual stuff if he's a good guy? You don't see it. Yeah, I don't know. That's a story for another day.
Do you remember Razor Ramon refusing to work with him? This was in early
1996. I don't remember that. I heard that. Now, to me, that's true homophobia. See, if you take homophobia, the word, it's not fear of homosexuals. It's really the fear of being one. So.
I want to ask this one as well. Is Dusty and Dustin, they have a fallout around maybe 94. Dustin leaves, goes to the WWF in 1995, and then does the Gold Dust character. And Gold Dust is about as far removed from Dustin, the natural Dustin Rhodes, as you can get. Some took the Gold Dust character as like a rib for some reason. Others took it as just some great like avant-garde theatre almost. But do you remember hearing at the time why Dusty and Dustin fell out? Or did you ever talk to Dustin about it?
Okay. I think they fell out because of who Dustin married. And Dusty didn't like it. I don't know why. That's for him to say, and he's not with us anymore. Or for Dustin to say. But I think Dustin would say the same thing, that I forgot her name now. She used to work in
Terry
the
Runnels.
Makeup department. Terry Runnels. She used to work in the makeup department. And I think WCW and WWF. Both. Well, maybe not both. But I do remember meeting her in WWE, which was WWF then. And that's where Dustin met her. So they ended up kind of liking each other and ended up getting married. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I just wheeze massively into the microphone then. I'm trying to think of what else we've got here, because I know you've got to go relatively soon. So there's a few questions here that I can leave for another time. It's Harley Race here that I want to ask for another time as well. Bruce Pritchard claims that Dusty Rhodes could have been the man to lead the WWF's national expansion instead of Hulk Hogan, or actually replacing Hulk Hogan when he went over from WCW to WWF in early 1989. Do you think Dusty could have done as good a job as Hogan?
Well, maybe. People buy what you show them or present to them. And Dusty had a track record behind him, a big one. I don't think he would have been the figure that Hulk was, but his interviews were like 10 times better. His body was like 10 times worse. So the beauty of that whole thing lies in its execution and its presentation. And so who's to say? I think Dusty could have replaced him at least for a short time, but Dusty had more experience in getting over. Hulk had to have use the experience of every agent and Vince on that whole show to get over. But both of them shared one thing. You didn't see them on TV every week. So they were equal in that regard. And Vince made it a point that if you wanted to see Hogan, you had to buy a ticket. Dusty made it a point to tell the people, if you want to see me live, you got to buy a ticket. And back in those days, we made most of our money off the live house shows instead of pay-per-views. So whether the fact that he could have been as successful as Hogan, it remains to be seen.
With Dusty, we can't think of the WWF run without the polka dots. Now, Bruce Pritchard, now this is Bruce saying, of course, that Vince came up with the idea of the yellow polka dots as, he just thought it was a great idea to sort of just add a bit of flavour to Dusty's presentation, as if he needed it. Pretty much everybody else out there says that that was just one giant prank on Dusty to make him look as stupid as possible. What do you think?
No, I don't think Vince wants to make one of his guys like Dusty look stupid. I do not believe that at all. I think Vince gave him the yellow polka dots out of concern about how he's going to be received. Vince knew that he was a big, kind of a fat guy, and he was. And he would tell you that too, Dusty would. So if the talk he does, the things he does, it's like a parody of wrestling to begin with. So why not go the whole route and give him some pink polka dots or yellow polka dots or whatever they were. And if Dusty had no qualms about wearing them, I mean, why did he wear them? He could have went to Vince and said, this is making me look stupid, and Vince could disagreed with him. But yet he knew Dusty could make him a little money, and he did. But just not in a main event spot.
Did you ever meet Sapphire?
I never met her.
No, she was a fan in St. Louis, apparently. She used to drive wrestlers around at the time. I don't know, because I know you went to St. Louis. I don't know if it was for a week or a match, or what, was it wrestling at the Chase, the hotel?
Never wrestled at the hotel. I went to St. Louis with WWE for pay-per-view or a house show. Good crowd. Responsive crowd.
I thought you actually wrestled like in the 70s just once. I've got it somewhere. There's like maybe 76 you actually went to St. Louis.
Maybe. Probably. But I went for out of Kansas City, because I've spoken before about St. Louis being like Houston and Chicago. They were outlying towns that weren't associated with any one territory. They would get the bulk of their territory, of their talent. Chicago would get it from Minneapolis or Indianapolis. Chicago would. And St. Louis would get it from Indianapolis and Kansas City, a lot of it, because they could drive in. And Houston would get a lot of their talent from the Texas territory or the Mid-South territory. But they were, and they had separate TVs. They didn't take, say, in Houston, they didn't take the Mid-South tape and run it there. They did their own TV, and they kept their town separate. And I forgot who the promoter was in St. Louis.
Sam
I guess
Mushnick.
It was a. And I forgot who was a promoter in Chicago. Remember?
No, the Sheik. I mean, I can't remember.
It wasn't him. And Houston was Paul.
That was Detroit. Sorry. Paul Bosch.
Paul Bosch. Now, Paul Bosch, to me, was the best payoff man in the business. Because if you were working Mid-South, if you had Houston on your schedule, that made you weak. You could go in there and first match, and this is in the 80s, you could pick up anywhere from $500 to $800 in Houston on a good house, and you might not make you might make $400 in the rest of the territory where you're working. So you have a good week then. When you saw Houston on your schedule, you knew you'd have a good week.
It was Fred Kohler, by the way, I think, in Chicago. Who would generally book you in Houston? Would it be a relationship with Mid-South? Would it be who would it be a relationship with? Who would get you booked there?
I was working in out of Dallas with the Von Erichs, that they would get me there. I have one match there. I think it was me and Killer or somebody.
Is it Tim Brooks?
It was Killer Brooks, yeah. Tim Brooks, and Gary Hart versus the Von Erichs. I think that was my first night in Houston. So, and I forgot who they beat. I think they beat me. Well, by rights, they should beat me. But it was actually a good match.
Hey, $500 to $800 back then as well. That's a big old payoff for an opening match as well.
For one day? Oh, yes, it is. Mm.
I think you were leaving JCP at the time. In fact, you just said you were in 1987. What do you remember of Jim Crockett buying out Bill Watts's UWF? And why? I don't know if you've ever done an invasion, a booking of an invasion, even in Puerto Rico, who knows? But why did the UWF invasion booking, why was it just so terrible?
Well, it was just an idea, I think, that they come up with. I had nothing to do with it. I don't think they understood it. I think just because people know Charlotte wrestling is there, or Mid-Atlantic wrestling is there, most of the people who watch TV weren't even aware of Mid-South, unless the people just read the magazines or read the dirt sheets, and they weren't that accessible then. And it was a badly executed plan that wasn't really what was the point of it. It didn't last long. And I think they give up on that Mid-South idea pretty quick.
Yeah, I believe UWF was losing about $50,000 a week, and Crockett bought out the promotion for about $4 million. I mean, it's like, what are you paying for there? Because like, none of the wrestlers are under contract or any meaningful contract that you just can't bring them in for free.
Crockett was alarmed that the WWF were taking over areas of the country. And they were already everywhere in the country anyway. So I think what Crockett wanted to do was kind of save the part that he was familiar with, but he ended up just losing more money. So, and that's probably why he allowed WWE to absorb the Mid-Atlantic territory. Mm. He was in debt.
WCW, Dr. Death, Sting, maybe Rick Steiner, they're the only ones who really come out of it good. Dusty, I believe, just booked everyone else to beat all the Jim Crockett guys to beat all the UWF, and then they just killed the territory off completely. And $4 million down the hole for no reason. We will end this podcast now on this fun fact. Dusty Rhodes had a donkey named Zeb.
What the hell? A donkey named Zeb. It'd be a good movie. We need to write that.
Yeah, a horror film. We will shut the podcast down. So once again, we do plugs. We've got books. You know where they are. They're in the descriptions of the Amazon. Give us 5 stars on iTunes if you enjoyed that. And there's a T-shirt somewhere as well. You can buy links somewhere. And there are more T-shirts coming out as well. But for now, thank you very much for watching from SeaWorld in Orlando, Dutch. We the people.
We the people.